Hey there, Kelly here. Guests on the show share so many great ideas, but how do you start putting them into practice? Well, that's exactly what you'll explore when you sign up for the Podcast Weekly Newsletter. Each week, you'll get 3 ideas from past guests sent straight to your inbox. You'll explore materials, techniques, tools, concepts, and mindsets in bite-sized pieces so that you can think about them and fold them into your own practice. It's completely free, and you get it by signing up at learntopaintpodcast.com/newsletter.
I think as I do this thing longer, I can start to appreciate more subtle colors and save the really brilliant cadmiums and things like that for special moments in the painting.
Hello and welcome to the Learn to Paint podcast, the show that gives you artistic tools you can put to work. I'm your host, Kelly Ann Powers. Today, I'm talking with artist Ingrid Christensen. In the conversation, you'll discover how your artistic heroes can help you solve problems in your own work, the benefits of working with a palette of 6 colors, and why it's so important to have a plan, but then also stick to the plan, plus a whole lot more. In the extended cut bonus available to Podcast Art Club members, you'll get a great strategy for dealing with saturation and ideas for how to build a painting process that mirrors how we actually see. For show notes and to see some of Christensen's work, head to learntopaintpodcast.com/podcast/episode87. I start the interview by asking Christensen how she got started in art.
I'm not even sure why I started, but I know I got started sitting around my kids' swimming pools lessons every summer, and I was just looking for ways to pass the hours, and I was looking at art books. And that, I mean, I, like every other artist, I was the kid who was always drawing, and I covered all of my homework with drawings, and I loved art class best of all, but I really didn't make it a career. I was doing other things to make some actual money. But art always called me back. And when the kids were little, that was a time for me to pick up a brush because there was nothing else you could do. So if they were napping or if they were in elementary school or preschool, rather, you could pick up a brush for a couple of hours. So I started in watercolor and that hooked me. And then when they went to school full time in the older grades, I could have the hours to explore oil painting, which has become my absolute love.
Was there a moment that you decided, I want to get really good at this?
I can't remember that moment. I'm sure it happened. I would look at every painting, and I still do. I would look at every painting and say, oh, it's just not what I want it to be. I had this idea of what it would look like in my head, or at least I pictured this magic coming out of my brush. And it didn't come out of my brush on this one. I will try again, and I will, you know, read more and look at more art. And it just became this evolving roller coaster thing where I feel like I could do a thing, but I couldn't do all those other things. And then I'd explore those other things. So for example, I wanted certain brush marks and I would work really hard at that. And then I'd feel like, okay, I'm starting to get a hang of how to, you know, layer paint, get those brush marks, express that vigor that I want in a paint surface. And then I'd realize that my colors really were limp or too dark or whatever. And so then I'd address color for a while and I'd do all these things that were just really focused on color. Get that to where I felt like I was starting to get a handle on a bit about color, though that's like, it'll take a few lifetimes to do that one. And then I'd realize that it really doesn't matter how great your color and brushwork are if your composition is really lame. So then I would work on composition. And it's just been like that, this slow forward momentum where I focus on one thing at a time because I realize there's a real weakness in my work. And then I try to get a handle on that and realize that, yes, I thought I had color under control, but I realize now it's still got so far to go. So I think it's a lifetime thing. You know, you spend a lifetime learning how to do it. Some artists said, spend a lifetime learning how to do it, and then you need a lifetime to implement it.
Well, it sounds like you really let curiosity drive you. Did you have to deal with any of the feelings of like, oh, I need to be better faster. Oh, I want to be there, like those expectations that we bring in? How did you balance that with like, no, like, this is what we're going to focus on next?
I think it's always there. You know, I joined a couple of local art clubs that would have exhibitions that you could put your work into a couple of times a year, each one. And sometimes they were juried. And so that was a bit of an eye-opener to have somebody critique your work and say, yeah, not good enough for this community center exhibition. And you go, whoa. And then you get a little bit of ambition a little bit of competition, or else perhaps you drop out. But I never felt that I wanted to abandon it. So I just worked a little bit harder around those things. But also, I think those things can hold you back. They can make you feel like your vision is not valid. And so what I was doing was not what I mostly saw in those local art shows, which tended to be lots of mountains. And, you know, I live in a beautiful part of near the Rockies in Canada. And so it was filled with really beautiful landscape art, but that wasn't really the thing that I was trying to paint. I was trying to paint figures, and I did still life as well, florals. And so, you know, it would be easy to be discouraged because you're being judged for these exhibitions by people who are predominantly landscape painters. And because of that, they haven't really spent the time looking at or being interested in figurative work. And, you know, and vice versa, I would look at their landscapes and go, well, that's nice. But for me, it was, if somebody put in a little tiny figure in the landscape, I'd just zoom in on that. So we've all got our biases.
But it sounded like you were pretty clear and then also trusted that instinct that you knew you wanted to do figurative work at the time.
I think I always knew that I wanted to do figurative work because it was what I was most attracted to when I was teaching myself to paint. And I taught myself largely by looking at other people's work in art books. So Sargent, for example, there were some fabulous big coffee table books of Sargent's work. And the way that he could gracefully capture a figure, the ease that he could convey in the clothing, you know, he had a real he was magical. So it was painters like that that I was looking at. I was also looking at the Impressionists for their use of color because it really resonated the way that they found light and color in their shadows. Their shadows were just so different from what had come before, that sort of Rembrandt-y, homogenous, umbery, warm shadow. The Impressionists found cools in the shadow and purples and greens and anything else that was bouncing into it. And so, yeah, you know, figures and color resonated with me right from the start.
Did you build your skills through finished paintings, or did you do studies, or a combination of both?
I think every painting is a study. And if you're lucky, you look at it at the end and you say, oh, you know what? I popped that in a frame and it's actually looking pretty good. So there it is. It's a painting now. Yeah, with every painting, it's a study. And I'm always willing to say, no matter how big the painting is, if it's not something that I'm really proud of and I feel is really resolved, then I call it just a learning experience and I put it aside and try another one that has some of those good elements, but hopefully doesn't have the flaws of the last one. I think, you know, as a painter, I have always been really hard on myself, really critical of my work, not in a bad way. I always appreciate what I'm doing at the time. And I think, wow, this is going so well. But at the end, you know, given a few weeks to see it on the shelf, I'm willing to recognize if it doesn't meet my high expectations for it. And then I'll revise it and revise it. And eventually it will either become something that's more close to what I hope it would be, or it will be completely dead. But, you know, you've got to know that you can just keep pushing a painting. And for me, that was actually the biggest revelation, was that I can keep pushing a painting much further for the first number of years that I was learning than I thought I could. You know, I thought you kind of had one go at this, the alla prima go at it. And if it didn't work out, then that was just a dead painting. But over the years, I've realized you can save the majority and turn them into something else. You know, they can be more layered. They can just kind of move on and get a richer, deeper life.
So did that sort of like a mental shift happen when you shifted from alla prima to more of a layered painter?
Yes, it absolutely did. And it happened because I was looking at so much art. I look at just a ton of art. I admire so many painters, historical and contemporary. I think at last count, I was following 1,260 painters on Instagram. And literally, it's just all painters and a couple of sculptors. And so I see so much really wonderful art and different ways to approach art. And I take a little bit from some of them. So I would have a painting that was stalled, and then I would have this remembrance of a piece by somebody else who had handled shadows in a totally different way than I would have thought. And it's like, oh, that might actually fix this painting. So I could take that, all of that inspiration and sort of visual education, and apply it to my paintings. And once I started doing that, getting out of the idea that it's got to be an alla prima, and just saying, well, it can just keep going. I can just keep throwing more and more layers on this. That's, I think, when I started to understand the richness of what I could be doing in the studio. Before that, Alla Prima was just an amazing way to become swift and decisive on the canvas. But after a while, it started to feel like, well, you know, is there nothing else than just Alla Prima? So now I kind of do this balance between the two of them. But increasingly, what I love is to have a painting on the go for weeks or even months at a time and just come back and toss on a little change and let it dry and live with it for a while and then think about it some more, do some more.
What do you love about oils as a medium? Like, what does oils give you that watercolor didn't?
Watercolor is the most luminous and difficult medium. I absolutely loved it, and I went quite large with it. I was doing, you know, full sheets of paper. I was doing large figurative work, but then you have to frame under glass a full sheet of watercolor paper. And it's just incredibly expensive. And it was also kind of hard to sell because people wanted canvas on their walls. So, and as well, it's just a more delicate look and it doesn't have the texture that oil paint has. So then I tried acrylics thinking, well, that's, you know, that's my next step. And I could never make anything that didn't look really flat and, to my eyes, just not what I was after in acrylics. So then I tried oils and that just felt like what I was after. You could make that with great effort. You could make the luminosity of watercolor. You could work it for a long time, as you can with watercolor. You could go back in and reactivate watercolors, which I did all the time, and you know, feed one color into another and layer and all of that stuff. And the same thing is possible with oils because they're open for so long. So I could come back into the studio the next day or two and it would still be workable for a while. And that was really forgiving as a, you know, I think it's the most forgiving medium to learn on. You can always just give it a scrape and take another run at an area that's not working. It had all sorts of things going for it. It was on canvas. Oils are luscious and buttery to play with. It's like playing with frosting. And you can get really rich color. You can apply so many different techniques to it, from transparency to opacity to a real sculptural impasto. And I still have so much to learn from it. Like every day I go, oh, wow, look at that mark. This new brush, this changed everything.
How many colors do you generally have on your palette?
It varies. I've got a foundational 6 plus black and white. So I use a double primary palette with a warm and a cool of each primary. Then I add things because after a while you get to know them so very well, which is a good thing. You can mix pretty much anything you want, but it's also a kind of a thing that bores you after a number of years. So the same palette for years and years can start to feel like, yeah, I know exactly what I'm going to get when I mix these two. So once in a while, I will throw other colors on my palette. And increasingly adding to those primaries, I have added some low chroma colors. So some earth colors, you know, terra rosa, yellow ochre, Indian red. I'm appreciating, I think as I do this thing longer, I can start to appreciate more subtle colors and save the really brilliant cadmiums and things like that for special moments in the painting. And it's just, you know, an expansion of the 6.
For paintings, do you generally use all 6 or do you pull out 2 or 3 and use just those?
No, I definitely use all 6. The wonderful thing about a double primary is that you can have, you have the 2 temperatures in each color. So you can confine one of the temperatures, say you've got somebody in a blue shirt in the sun. You could put your ultramarine as the foundation for the shadow mixtures and then use, my other blue would be phthalo. You can put phthalo into the mixtures in the light side and really give what the brain loves, which is contrast. So not only contrast of value, because shadows will be darker in their value than the lights, but also you can give contrasts of temperature. And so you're sort of working 2 real pleasure spots at once in the brain. The brain's going, oh, wow, look, there's dark against light. I love that contrast. And then you see they're both blue, but they're totally different blues. And I love that too. So I think that as a painter, I'm always looking for as much contrast as I can. But the thing that I do minimize actually is value contrast. So I tend to work more in mid values and let the color temperature really do a lot of work. And that's just an aesthetic preference. I always had that right from the start. So I think we have a tendency towards tonalism or color biases, and I'm definitely a color bias person.
Thinking about your materials still, what brushes do you use? And more importantly, like, what do you want from your brushes?
I use predominantly hog bristle, and usually it's long flats, although I do enjoy rounds as well. What I like about them is that they can hold a lot of paint, and they can layer. If you've got a light touch, you can layer an awful lot wet in wet with a hog bristle brush and get a show through. So it's like, you know, that broken color effect that, say, the Impressionists really had in their work, where you've got colors showing through multiple layers, and it really gives a just a wonderful vibration, which again pleases the brain. And when you've layered enough, you know, think about a Monet painting, and he would have done a lot of wet on dry as well. When you see a Monet painting with its multiple little broken layers, and how something as simple as a hay bale can just be glowing madly, that's the joy of a natural hairbrush that will spread apart. And I've never had that much success doing that with synthetic brushes, because they tend to be either too aggressive or too soft, and I have to use more medium. And as soon as I've added more medium, they no longer break apart. They create this kind of smooth, closed mark where the other marks aren't showing through. So I might get wet in wet blending, but it's more of a, it is an absolute mingling. Whereas with the hog's bristle brushes, I can lay one broken layer on top of another. So I could have like a blue foundation, and with the brush, gently lay some orange on top, and the orange stays distinct largely from the blue. The blue shows through wherever the brush bristles have separated a little bit, which hog bristle does so nicely. So I really love hog bristle, and I also like how much abuse it can take. I've got a fairly heavy hand, and I push hard on my surfaces, and hog bristle can stand up to that.
Well, then what surfaces do you work on?
Mostly either birch panels for smaller works, or I really like oil-primed linen, Belgian oil-primed linen. I'm a, who doesn't love that? And that's for larger pieces, because birch at a great at a larger expanse, you have to cradle, and it gets really heavy and bulky.
Well, then, could you give us a bird's eye view of your process?
A bird's eye view is that I work in a shape-based manner. So I learned how to paint from books. I learned from people like Richard Schmidt's Aloprima book. Fantastic. But he would recommend you start with like a transparent red iron oxide color, and you would put it in through all of your darks and shadows, and then you would go to actual colors and put them on top, and you'd try to leave some of that transparent red iron oxide showing in all of the shadows. So a very tonalist approach, and that's how I learned. And it just never really gave me the colors that I was looking for. And then I started noticing, I mean, there are now so many painters I could name, painters who don't start that way. They start with the actual local color of each shape, an average. And that really changed my work hugely when I did that. So no longer massing in the darks, but instead thinking about what are the major shapes? How few shapes can I see this scene as? So for example, if I'm doing a still life and there's a red, I've got a red container that I frequently put in it, I would just put an average red on that. And then as my second coat, I would drop in the shadows and drop in the lighter parts. So I start from an average in each shape, and it looks very simple and just very flat when I start. And then I drop in shadows, I put in lights, and I start noticing the smaller shapes on top of that big average shape. And that process of noticing smaller shapes can take many layers and a whole lot of looking. But the first block in is just covering up the canvas with shapes that have no white space around them, getting rid of all the canvas color and just putting average colors in each shape. And that really gets me a color space right from the start. And then I can develop it.
When you say average, does that mean you're sort of doing the mid-tone of all those?
It sort of is, yeah. It's not the lightest light and it's not the darkest dark. It's kind of the glancing view. If you've got an arrangement on the table of apples and containers and whatnot, it's the view from across the room and you're just glancing or you're looking peripherally at it and you see these color relationships. I always say it's as if you gave a young child a box of crayons and said, draw this still life. And they would just see a lemon and they'd grab a lemon color and they'd smack it on. And it wouldn't be the highlight color and it wouldn't be the shadow color. It would be an average yellow. And if I can keep myself to that child's view, that simple, this is the average color and value that I'm seeing there, I just have so much more success than if I'm being kind of fancy and going, well, you know, let's put in that, make sure that highlights color is in there right from the start and do the shadows first. And then I end up struggling with value and color if I go about it that way. Whereas if I just go from the child's point of view, it's so much easier.
So often guests on the show will say, look at your shapes, don't think about objects. But what I hear you saying is like you're thinking about the object in terms of shape, like you're still thinking in terms of shape, but you do have the object in mind. So how do you not get, because your work is very loose, so how do you not get stuck in like, oh no, this is an apple, it has to look like an apple, this is what an apple looks like?
I think about color first, and then later I think about turning it into the object. So I do in my mind know that I'm dealing with apples and containers and flowers, but once I've arranged the still life, I try and I arrange it with color in mind too. So repetition of color, movement of color through the setup. And I'm not thinking there's an apple here, so there must be an apple there. It's more there's a patch of red here, so I'm going to put a patch of red there. And it might be in another apple, as it turns out, or it might be in a flower or a reflected color or whatever. So I'm always thinking about composing with color and developing color first. And then later that big sort of patch of colors and values and noticings of here it's cooler, there it's warmer, all of those things can easily be chiseled into an apple at the end. So in the last 10 or 15% of the painting, I am then looking at edges and thinking, okay, this grouping of various reds and oranges and lights and darks right here, I need to turn that into a suggestion of multiple apples. So how few marks can I use to turn that into an apple? Because the more little marks I make and the more outlining or edge creation, the less the color is the thing that people will notice. They'll start to notice the outline, or they'll, you know, the more you break up color with small marks, the less color is the thing that you notice about that. Instead, you notice all those little small detail marks. So I try to keep my shapes as big patches of color for as long as possible. And also I recognize that when our amazing brains look at a piece, we easily turn something quite ambiguous into a thing. And we can easily see that patch of red over there with just one or two little curvy marks to suggest the outline. We can turn that into apples, you know, put in something that looks stem-like, and suddenly the viewer knows exactly what's going on there. And we don't have to do as much work as I think many people think we do to suggest apple. So yeah, I try not to think in terms of the noun. I try to think in terms of shapes of color and value and really develop that for as long as possible before I say, and now let's make it an apple.
Does that mean for that sort of first layer, you're massing color shapes? Like if there's a bunch of apples in a group, that will be one sort of that mid color?
Yeah, that's exactly how I think about it. And I try to join as many shapes as I can, which is very much back to the tonalist approach of joining all your darks, but I join colors of similar value. So if there's a red container with a cast shadow behind it on a white wall and the cast shadow is bluish, if they're a similar value, I will obscure the edge, let one edge just flow into another, not try to keep them separate. It's a way to move color through the composition. My ideal is that every object, every shape in that composition feels like you can't just pluck it out. Like it's so woven in, its color has been blurred into other colors so much that it's integrated. So that's what I strive for. So yes, I'm massing color and I'm slurring color together. So I make each color shape bigger than it's going to end up being so that I can deliberately swipe it into its neighbor and thereby infuse that neighbor with a bit of the color and integrate the object, which is actually how we see. You know, we don't see things as discrete and separate from each other. We easily see lost edges in daily life. We also easily see color migrating from one thing to another. So if I put a bowl of lemons in sunlight in front of my coffee cup, I would easily see how the lemon color migrates into the coffee cup and even into the air around it. As the sun is glowing off of it, there's a yellowy sensation around those lemons in the air.
So once you have that average local color in, what do you look for next? And what do you build in next?
The next thing is the shadow. And that's where the double primary is so handy. So if I've got my scarlet container in my still life, in the light side, where I'm really just seeing the scarlet color being struck by my light source, I will use my warm red CAD red light. And in the shadow side, I'll mix up something that is based on alizarin permanent, my other red. And so I've got a cooler red shading, you know, as the foundation for the shadow of a warmer red. And so I do that around all of the forms. I just knock in a sense of the light and the shadow. And right away, that starts to suggest objects, though I try never to think about that. I just say right here, there's a darker value. And it's, I always say to myself, it's about this big, so that I don't find an edge and then just carefully stick to it, you know, and create that coloring book kind of filling in the outlines, which is not something that pleases my brain. As I'm doing it, I feel sort of restricted by outlines. So I do that next. I put in the shadows. I sometimes, especially if it's a tricky color, I will find my lightest light and pop in just a little bit of that on each of the important shapes, just so that I know these are my parameters. Here's my darkest dark on that shape. Here's an average. This is the absolute lightest I'm going to go on that shape. And then everything else happens within that. So that piece of lightest light frequently gets brushed over and then restated many times as I start to look at all of the variety that I can see within the average and the shadow. So in the shadow, for example, I might see some of the color of the background drape bouncing into that shadow or a neighboring object. So I will try to keep it at shadow value, but infuse the shadow with some of that color. And I do the same thing with the average, you know, in the light side. I will see that, you know, maybe it's cooler up at the top where my ceiling, my white ceiling, is influencing the color. And it's warmer at the bottom of that object where the warm drape that it's sitting on is affecting it. Or, you know, something else is bouncing into it. So I will notice all of those variations from the average. And that can go on for a nice long time, because the more you look at something, the more you start to see how rich and varied it truly is. And then I just have something about the way I paint just really enjoys trying to capture and show to the viewer all of those amazing things in that simple red canister. I want them to see, well, down here, it's a little more pinkish, and up there, it's a little more orange. And over there, there's this weird spark of green that comes from the leaves on the flower over on the, you know, across the setup from it. And I really enjoy that process. So I'm just making, you know, from that big, simple, childlike average, I make smaller and smaller noticings until I feel like I've noticed enough for that shape. And then I start to think about, how does it interact on its periphery with other shapes? And then I start thinking about edges, also things like dark accents, just pull it into focus, little crisp highlights, pull it into focus. But those sorts of things happen in the last 10 or 15%. For the majority of the painting, I'm simply exploring smaller and smaller shapes of color.
Do you do that across the whole painting at once, or do you really focus on the canister and bring it up to a certain point before moving to, let's say, flowers or an apple?
Mostly I work all over the canvas, but I do spend more time at the focal area. I know my focal area. That's kind of the key, knowing the point of the painting. It's about this part of the bouquet, and or it's about that little sculpture. And so I do spend more time on those areas. And then with decreasing amounts of input, I move on out from that. I try not to work too long in one place, because of course, if I put a lot of development into a secondary area, then that means I have to do even more in the focal area, and that focal area can start to feel kind of overdone. So I try to work all around and keep the whole painting coming up at about the same rate.
You know, you mentioned that you know, like the whole painting is integrated and woven together, and also you're, especially in your focal area, but also other places too, like you're putting in a lot of information. Like, this is a warm glow, this has cooler bounced light. How do you keep all of that information still cohesive, like that keeps the shape of the thing?
Yeah, and I lose that now and again. And the way that I work does mean that frequently I'm looking at something that's kind of chaotic on the easel. And there are so many moving parts, I guess. You know, you're very right. It is hard to keep track of across a bigger surface. And I take a lot of breaks because of that, because I do find that I can lose my way and need to just regroup and remind myself, what is my aim for this painting? And that always focuses me again. And I can say, okay, it's not about this little secondary or tertiary importance object off on the periphery. It's about this area with the flower and the vase and canister. And then I take a break. I come back with fresh eyes and I just go to that area and say, okay, how much more does this actually need? I always look at a mirror. I look at the piece in a mirror, which keeps me focused because I can see it reversed, which is a good thing. It's like looking at it with fresh eyes. And also it's smaller. So in my studio, behind my back, 7 or 8 feet, I've got a big wall-mounted mirror. And it helps keep me, it organizes the chaos because I can look in the mirror and see everything scaled down and reversed and say, okay, that red shape is too big. So that launches me to, how am I going to cut down that big red shape there? Or this area, which I know to be my focal area, isn't glowing, but something across the canvas is actually glowing. So I know that even though I'm not thinking about shapes yet, I've got glow in the wrong place. And so I can spend a lot of time just moving the glow to where it will eventually become flowers and vases. But until then, it just needs to be beautiful color interactions. So it's a slow process. My work, I think, looks fast, but it's actually really slow because I'm always considering the whole canvas and what's happening in every part of it.
It also, I imagine, with that much going on visually, and in how you build it up, right? So it's not all spelled out from the beginning. How important is it then for you to really be clear on what your goal is for this area you're about to go into?
Yeah, it's huge. And I work a lot from still life because it's always there. It's always accessible to me. It doesn't cost me any money like model fees to have a still life. So I spend a really long time setting up my still life with an awareness of the point of this painting. So any one still life could be numerous paintings. I just need to change my idea of what I'm trying to convey. So in one, I might be all about the light falling on those petals, but in another one, I might be about the complexity of those petals. And I would paint it totally differently depending on what my concept is. So I do have to keep track of the point that I was trying to make with that individual painting. And for a long time, when I was busy overworking paintings and doing too much in one area and realizing, gosh, I've just developed the heck out of this secondary area and the focal point is weak. When I was busy doing that, I started to just write my concept, my goal for the painting on a piece of paper and post it on the easel so that I could always look at it. And when I would look in the mirror and get that overall view, I could refer back and say, am I working towards this concept? And as soon as I felt I had achieved it, I would stop. And that's, I think, the hardest thing is to make yourself stop when you know that the secondary areas are still pretty rough and undeveloped. But for me, as long as those secondary areas have good color, whether it's high or low chroma, and they have approximately the right shape, and the paint doesn't feel too meager so that I'm seeing, you know, sort of miserable canvas poking through, I don't love that look. So if all of those things are met, then I don't let myself go and busily develop those secondary areas and, you know, sort of slap your hand away and put the brush down and walk away because it's so tempting, especially with still life. It's there forever. And so you could just keep plucking away at all these secondary areas. So knowing my concept is vital to keeping me from beating a painting to death needlessly.
You know, I'm struck by there's a discipline and a habit in learning to walk away like, nope, did it. But there's also a discipline in committing to an idea. Like you said, like a still life could be a dozen different ideas, but you can only commit to one. Did you have to learn that discipline of like, no, I can't paint everything. What is the idea of this painting?
Yeah, and that took so many years. It just took so many years to understand that painting is about saying something, just like an essay has a thesis and, you know, a novel has this narrative arc and something happens. There's a resolution that comes from that. A piece of music has a theme that runs through it. And a painting has a point, just like all of those other art forms. And it took me a long time to realize that. But I did know that until I came to that understanding, I frequently made things that had so much information and I'd look at it and go, well, there it is, you know, and it felt sort of empty. It was done, but it wasn't in any way meaningful. It was just a pretty picture. But when I recognized the need to impose my concept onto it. The thing that drew me to that subject in the first place is usually what I'm trying, is of course what I'm trying to convey to the viewer. You know, notice this thing, notice all of those colors, notice the way the light hits here and that crisp little accent and the way the glow moves, and notice these things. And there's a hierarchy of things I want you to notice. And once I started looking at a painting in terms of how I want the viewer to understand it, to look at it, then it became really engrossing, because then it's like a game. You know, I can move the viewer's eye to this place, but then I can't just bullseye them to the focal point. I've got to move them around the rest of the composition. But to what degree? How much time do I want them to look at this quadrant as opposed to that quadrant of the canvas? And that becomes really a marvelous thing, where you can manipulate the painting to move the eye so many different ways and still keep your master plan of, I want them to know this is the most important part. And you can just spend ages doing that. It's really quite, it's challenging and it's invigorating. And you really feel like you're painting with all of your energy, all of your attention and awareness when you paint with a point.
For you, when you're setting up a still life, I imagine that with a still life that you're setting up, you have time to sort of daydream and then come to a decision. Like, there's time to be immersed in the thing as you're setting it up. But you also work from reference photos sometimes. So how do you give yourself that space? Or even like with a plein air where the like light is shifting, how do you give yourself that space to sort of audition those ideas and then come to a true intent for this painting?
Yeah, exactly. Photos are a bit of a different story than plein air, but with photos, I have done so much working from life, whether it's from models or from still life or landscape plein air, that I can look at a photo and just see it as a bunch of shapes and say, okay, I know all of these values are wrong because a photo can never capture values in the way the human eye does. And I know all of these colors are bereft or shifted in some way. And so I bring all of the years of life work to the photo. And I say to myself, I know I don't have the information here, but I can extrapolate from all the things I've painted in the past from life. I know I can put some color here that will work with that color there, and it will feel plausible. So with photos, it's mostly just a remembrance of all of the life work that I bring to it. And then when I'm outside plein air painting, that's a whole different kettle of fish. And I have to work super fast because, as you said, the light is changing. It's changing like every half hour. You look and the shadows are in a different place and a cloud has just moved in and everything's different. So for that, knowing my palette as well as I do is really helpful. So those six colors plus black and white, I've used them for so many years that I know exactly how to make mixtures, and I pre-mix everything. And I don't work very large when I go plein air painting. So I just kind of put all of the shapes, colors onto my palette in advance. And I know my focal area. I've done, you know, little thumbnails, or at least in my mind, I'm really well aware of how the eye is supposed to flow through it and where is the focal area. So I pre-mix, I make sure that when I look at it on the palette, those mixtures show the most beautiful color and perhaps the strongest contrast, but definitely the most beautiful color interactions happening at the focal point. And if it looks good on the palette, then I can just sketch it in roughly with my brush onto the canvas or the board and quickly smack in all of those average colors. You know, the mixing can take 15, 20 minutes. The applying those shapes might take 5 or 6 minutes. And then the rest of the time is developing the focal area and then secondarily developing all the other areas so that the eye starts to move through. And then, you know, I've got time for the grace notes of accents and highlights and edges.
You mentioned that you have like the last 10 to 15% of finishing. Do you really switch modes? Like, are you like, and I know a lot of this might just be internal at this point, but is there a, okay, we are done building up the painting, now we're finishing the painting?
Yeah, there sort of is. I think it's, you know, it's just a natural evolution. It's like when you're cooking, you've got all these ingredients and you're kind of making it up as you go along. And it's like, oh, you know, could use a little paprika. And you're throwing a little of this and then it needs a little heat, needs this and that. And you're throwing a bunch of stuff at it because you're testing all along the way and saying, it's not quite there yet. It's not quite there yet. And then at a certain point, you can't think of anything else to do with it. And it feels like it's a done deal. And so then it might just be, well, it needs to be, you know, a little more diluted, or it needs to be, something needs to happen. That's just a small thing. And then we're good to go, you know, serve it. And it's like that with a painting. I think there's to, you know, with every artist, it's to a different degree, but at a certain point you have developed, I have developed color as much as I want. The values seem right. There's nothing that feels like a big, dark, heavy piece in the middle of my luminous color field, still life. There's nothing that feels sort of weak and neutral. Neutral, I find really hard to deal with in colors. And so when I look at the whole painting and I feel like the eye is led through it via repetition of color and value, the weaving of color from one shape to another, and I truly don't know what to do next, then that's usually a point where I should stop and let it sit for a number of days. And now with a fresher set of eyes, is there something I still need to do? And if there really isn't, then I might just take a test run at a bit of an edge, a harder edge, you know, put in a piece of a hard edge in the focal area. I try not to put too many hard edges in because they really attract the eye. They are such a contrast to the way that the rest of the painting is. I work with very soft edges through the whole painting process. And so when I put in that first hard edge, it really makes me stop and evaluate it for a good long time. It's like, okay, is that too much? Is it too long, that edge? And then where else do I need to now put smaller supporting edges so that we don't just home in on that one? It's as if, I guess, I've run out of ideas for any of the big work. And then the small work just seems the only thing that needs to happen next. And it's very organic, you know, and sometimes I'll put in that edge and go, oh, whoa, I just suddenly realized that's done something to this whole area. And then I'll go back to big shapes for a while and sort out that area and then try it again. So it isn't a straight line. It's a back and forth.
If you're not building up edges, what information are you building up? Because like your brush is still laying down edges by making marks. So how are you not creating hard edges as you build up your painting?
Well, that's the beauty of long bristled hog bristle brushes, because they, I mean, if I've really loaded the brush and I've made a real hard mark, you know, that flat straight edge will be there. And so I try not to make those marks until much later in the painting process. John Singer Sargent, my absolute idol, told someone who watched him paint, you should begin with a whisk and end with a broom. And if you picture trying to apply paint with a whisk, it will just be this sort of soft edged, out of focus patch of color and value. But if you imagine loading up a broom and making a mark with that, suddenly you picture a beginning and an end to the mark. And so Sargent, I think what I take from that is you develop all those whisk colors and values for as long as you need to, knowing that when you put a few broom marks on top, they will take all of the attention. They will be the things that people look at and notice. So take your time before you make that broom mark, because you're right, it's full of edges and it tends to be more heavily loaded. So if we think about a Sargent dress on one of his figurative pieces, we don't so much think about all of the careful tonal shifts underneath that came first, all of the whisk development that came first. We think about that big sort of swooping brush mark that just goes straight across the entire lap, and it just looks so thick and juicy, like a big hit of bounce light off of that satin dress. But underneath, he has spent a lot of time developing smaller noticings of value and color. And so that's what I do. I'm aware that those big marks will draw all the attention, and so I reserve them. I might put one in and just see, okay, am I ready for you yet? And frequently, I haven't done enough of the building of the mid-values and the color shifts underneath it for that to feel like a natural progression to that mark. Because I do work generally, you know, from the mid-values up to the lights, down to the darks. And if I haven't developed the mids enough, then I put that light on and it just feels too abrupt. There isn't a good transition. So I'm building towards the light, but I try not to get it in so early because it is kind of a big thing when it goes down. It's filled with paint and usually a lot of white. And so I save it. It's like delayed gratification. You know, it's going to be fun, but you can't do it right away.
So that means when you're building up those mids, like you're keeping your contrast really low. And by contrast, I mean value contrast, but also brush mark contrast. Like you're blending all your edges.
Yeah, that's really right. That is what I'm doing throughout. I'm keeping an awareness that there will be lots of edges to come, lots of dynamic brush marks to come. Although over the years, I use, I think, probably fewer of those dynamic brush marks because I realized I was overusing them in the beginning. It's like I looked at Sargent, went, oh man, it's all about those big flourishy brush marks. And I was throwing them in everywhere, wasn't building the foundation for them, and was just thinking, this is a painting. It's full of those big showy marks. But now that I realize, with the benefit of years and years of practicing, I realize that those were the icing on the cake. You have to build the cake first, you know? And I do fewer of those marks, and I think that more meaningful placement of those marks. So it's not about the flourishes anymore for me. It's about the subtlety of color that I'm noticing has become the thing that really interests me, and how color interacts with light, what light does to color. And so because of that, those flourishy marks, they will distract from all of that color work if I let them get out of hand. So I can find them. I'm much more cautious with them than I used to be. As Sargent was, I mean, he was not throwing them around, but the uneducated eye that I had at the time thought, that's what a painting is. It's all those big showy marks. So you live and you learn.
Yeah, so a lot of this you can do in your head because of experience. But for your students and for people who aren't yet at that skill level, but they're trying to develop that, are there steps that you suggest that they walk through before they start a painting?
Yeah, absolutely. Know what they're trying to say and work from life. So I have always said to my students that they will learn more if they paint an apple a day than if they paint a photo every day. Because with you put an apple on a plate in a north window and suddenly its lights are cooler, the shadows, you'll see more warmth. And in the attempt to mix what you see teaches you so much about how dark is this thing that I'm seeing, or how light. Frequently when we start, we make our shadows way too dark because we're used to looking at photos which have these incredibly dark shadows. But you get a real sense of value range in the real world experience by painting from life. And then you take that same apple and the next day you put it in a south window, or you put it on a red plate as opposed to a white plate, and everything is changed. Like, there is nothing that you can use from the first day's mixtures in the north light that you can apply to the second day's mixture in the south light. It just is amazing. So a simple still life, as simple as an apple on a plate in different lighting conditions and with different background walled colors, can keep you going for months, and you will become such a subtle painter if you do that. That kind of work trains your eyes, trains you in how to mix the colors that you're seeing, you know, especially limiting your palette, as I did for so long, to those six colors. I didn't even include black. I just had six colors plus white for many, many years. And then you feel like, okay, I see this color, I can now mix it, and I know what value it is as well. And that's a huge thing. Then you can start applying that to other subjects, even photos. But also, you know, not just working from life, but starting to know why you're painting that thing. At first, we're just painting to learn how to mix those colors and see those values and transcribe them onto our canvas. But eventually, the goal is, and it might take years because it took me many years, the goal is to look at that thing and say, I really like this part of it. And I'm going to show the viewer the thing that I like about it. And so you put that apple on the plate, and maybe there's some beautiful blue color right on that edge where the sky from outside the window is somehow doing something right at the edge. And you go, oh man, that's a great looking apple, beautiful color, all that stuff. But really, I want to show them that amazing thing that's happening at the edge. And so you're taking it to another level where everything else becomes subordinated subtly to that amazing edge. It can't just be like a blasting blue edge on a red apple. So how subtly can I show it and it's still visible to the viewer? It's like this wonderful little treat that they never expected to see in an apple against a window. So no, eventually you start to realize you're trying to convey something about how you have seen that subject. You're trying to convey that to the people that look at your painting. So, you know, learn how to mix, learn how to gauge values, learn how to layer your colors wet in wet or wet over dry to show the colors and value shifts, but then also know that you're trying to say something about that simple apple on a plate, whether it's, you know, that beautiful color or it's the kind of dignity of it, sitting there so stoically for you. You know, the gravity of this simple round object that we see every day sitting there for you. And so then, well, how do I convey that? Well, maybe I crop it totally differently than I would if I were trying to show you that vibrating blue edge. And you start to realize that there's so much more in the way of tools that you can use, like cropping, like, you know, other things that lead you to that shape or that effect. And it really is, it's endless. You can become really quite subtle in how you look at things working from life.
So if someone came to you and said, I want to get really good at painting, what advice do you give them?
Paint from life. That's the one. That's it right there. There's really nothing else that teaches you like that. Paint from life. And as you're painting, try not to name the thing that you're painting. So Maggie Siner, in an article that I read, an interview with her, she said, don't paint nouns. That is absolutely the key for me, is to never name the thing that I'm working on. If it's an eye on a model or if it's a canister, I'm just painting a patch of color about this size in about this place. And it's, you know, I'm trying to mix the color as accurately as I can see it, but I'm not saying I'm painting this red canister, because as soon as I say that, then I start thinking about the perimeter of it and making it look very canister-like. Whereas if I just paint it as a red thing there, then I'll think about its essentially the space that it takes up, but I won't be thinking about its edges at all. As soon as I start thinking, I'm thinking lashes and pupils and this and that. But if I say I'm painting this shape and it's got a dark bit there and a light little catch on top, which might be the light on the eyelid, and underneath it there's this, you know, this piece of low chroma blue, and if I think about it like that, just it's this color and this shape and this value, I paint in a much more accurate way than if I say I'm painting an eye, because then all of the symbols that I'm used to, you know, an eye has this curve and then it's got these lashes and it's got this pupil and it's got all this stuff. And I stop looking as hard and I just go back to the symbols that I've had since I was in kindergarten for painting, drawing an eye. And I put those instead. And I don't recognize that, you know, well, that eye is actually in sort of three quarter view. So it's totally different than this oval sort of shape that I have made. So yes, paint from life. Don't name things as you're painting them. Don't give up on a painting too quickly, because you can absolutely work a painting for a really long time, particularly if it's still wet, if you're working in oils. But even acrylic painters, you can just keep throwing layers on, and not with an aim to obscuring what's underneath, but with an aim to just becoming more accurate each time and letting some of those early statements show through, and you make something really rich and increasingly honest and accurate the more you work it. So don't give up too quickly. I've known so many painters who, if they don't get it in the first half an hour, they're busy scraping it off and it's like, oh, that was just a start. You know, like, you can work that puppy for a long time. It would, again, like an essay, it's like if you just write your first paragraph and go, nope, can't do it, and you throw it out. Like, you just have to keep banging away at it and you get there. You can get a lot further with one painting, I think, than we realize. And along with not giving up on a painting too quickly is to not give up on yourself as a painter too quickly. I have known people who, they've taken lessons for a year or two or 10 or whatever, and they are so hard on themselves. They say, oh, I just can't do that. Oh, you just do that so well, and I can't possibly. And they have this self-talk, which I think is detrimental to their process. So I always encourage everybody, and I did this for myself, and I really believe it helped. I encourage everybody, when they've made a painting or they've been painting, maybe it's not a finished painting, they look at some at a part of it and they say, that little moment, that really works. Whether it's a nice mark, you know, the whole painting is like, I could take it or leave it, but there's this fabulous mark right there. Celebrate that. Notice it consciously. Stop and look at it and say, wow, look at that gorgeous mark that I did. And it was so casual and confident. Or this fabulous little glow that I got right there. And it's amazing. And maybe it's only a square inch out of a, you know, a 30 by 30 painting. But celebrate and notice those moments, because they will give you the heart to go on. It's not an easy thing to learn to paint. And I think we always have to pat ourselves on the back and say, you did a good thing here. And maybe I can do more of that, like go consciously into the next painting. Maybe I can do that again. But instead of saying, the whole thing's a dud, like what a waste of canvas and paint. And it's how we talk to ourselves, I think, will help us develop either into painters who love every minute at the easel, or painters who find it to be just hard and sort of defeating to be at the easel. So I think we've got to be kind to ourselves.
But also what I like about what you're saying is that that's learnable. Like, we can learn how to be kinder, like more positive painters.
Yeah, we absolutely can. And recognizing that everybody that you admire as a painter has put in just so much hard work and has ruined so much canvas. And it's just the nature of the game. And the biggest thing, I think, is for us to enjoy the moments we're at the canvas and not be so product oriented, which is another downfall. And just recognize that sometimes I'm just layering color and I get this gorgeous glow and I don't even know, you know, it's no longer even what I saw in the still life setup, but man, look at those colors. I'm so pleased with this. And you cut out that little piece and you post it on your studio wall and go, this is a great layering of colors that should have been an apple maybe, but who cares? So yeah, just it is learnable and you have to strike this balance between being a perfectionist, being self-critical, but also being self-loving and loving your work and loving the process of the work.
You can learn more about Ingrid Christensen, including her workshops, at her website, www.ingridchristensen.com, and on Instagram, and we'll link to everything in the show notes. Thank you so much for being with us today, Ingrid.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you for joining me this week on the podcast. Did you enjoy the episode? Take a screenshot and share it in your Instagram stories. Tag me at Learn to Paint Podcast so I can say hello and thank you. And if you want more great conversation with Ingrid Christensen, join us in the Podcast Art Club for the Extended Cut Bonus. In it, you'll get a great strategy for dealing with saturation and ideas for how to build a painting process that mirrors how we actually see. Plus, as a Podcast Art Club member, you'll get over 30 additional extended cut bonuses to explore. Plus, you'll get access to monthly group challenges, each designed to help you build practical tools into your art practice. Head to patreon.com/learntopaintpodcast to learn more or to sign up at any tier. Thank you to everyone over in the Podcast Art Club. You make this show possible. Extra shiny thank yous to High Gloss supporters Andrew Atterbury, Debbie and Brian Miller, Rihanna DeRold, Janet Wheeler, Nancy Bryant, Pam Lyle, and Slow River Studio. Happy painting!